Welcome back to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part series which focuses on the connection between land and culture and agriculture in New Mexico, looking at where culture and agriculture came from in the state and where it's going. In this show, we will look at the post-Guadalupe Hidalgo era, or the Americanization period, of the New Mexican bioregion. Fur trappers and explorers had been in the Mexican territory for years before the Mexican-American War, but in 1848, the U.S. took the northern areas of Mexico with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Based on the ideology of manifest destiny, the idea that the U.S. had a God-given right to take all the land that they wanted from the Atlantic to the Pacific, regardless of who was there first. With the signing of the treaty came the Americanization of the area.
The Europeans have passed through here since the 16th century. Explorers passed through here in the middle part of the 16th century, and then, of course, Don Juan de Oñate led a party of about 700 people passing through here on the way up north in 1598. But from 1598 to the early 19th century, there were no settlers, partly because this was very isolated and inhospitable, partly because the Apaches and other tribes were around and didn't allow settlers to stay for very long. So the Europeans who were here for that time period, just Paso Por Aquí, just passed by here on the way up to northern New Mexico on the El Camino Real.
Dr. John Hunter, public historian from New Mexico State University, talking about the transition period in southern New Mexico.
The first European settlers were it's hard to say because it's kind of lost in the mist of memory. There's a woman by the name of Doña Ana. We're in Doña Ana County, so our county's named after her. She supposedly had a hacienda a bit north of Las Cruces on the Rio Grande. And we don't know a lot about her, just that there's this mythical person, Doña Ana. But she did live there for a little while, maybe in the 1820s. After Mexico won its independence from Spain, Mexico started giving land grants to people in the southern part of the state here, as well as other parts. And so there were some land grants that European settlers started to get into in the 1830s. But it was always a bit dicey because of the Apaches who were around. But there were some land grants, 1830s, 1840s. Then in 1846, when the Mexican-American War occurred and the United States came in and took this land from Mexico, they brought in the military. And the military presence here was sizable, so much so that the Apache raids lessened, so that people then started creating bigger and bigger communities. And it was centered around agriculture. Centered around the river, even though the river's flows go up and down with the seasons and with rainstorms. But still, it was an agricultural way of life here from the 1840s for at least a few decades. It was some commerce. Las Cruces is at a crossroads north-south of El Camino Real, and then after the Santa Fe Trail came in, this part of the trail was called the Chihuahua Trail. And also east-west, the Butterfield Overland Stage Route. So Las Cruces, Mesilla were at a crossroads. So there was some commerce going on and some freighting, but mostly it was agriculture and ranching as well. They had some canal systems that came off the river. The acequia that goes through Mesilla just to the west of the plaza supposedly is the original canal system. But it's a little different than up north because there are no streams that you can bring an acequia off of like up north. The sole water supply is the Rio Grande.
Okay, well, this all started in homesteading. Everyone back east, New York, St. Louis, Boston, wherever, you know, to find a new start in the 20s, 30s, even 40s. Even teens, you know, my family came out here in 1906, so I guess I should say single digits all the way to the 30s, 40s.
So once the U.S. had a strong presence in the territory, they began to call for settlers. Then in 1906, the national government passed the Homestead Act to bring more settlers into the area. This is Jason Tillman, a cow-calf rancher Located south of San Juan on the eastern side of the state, he explains how his family came to the state.
Okay, you're living back east with your family and you're having a rough time, you know. You're trying to get a job and the government is offering you a free 160 acres per person if you go out and live on this land for 3 years. And the way they advertise the land, and it's funny because I have the original thing for out here. The way they advertise it, I mean, you would have thought, like, this was Garden of Eden out here. You could grow grapes and everything. Just the way the government advertised the Homesteading Act. Because, basically, people got on trains blind, like, whole family. Like, here we all go. Load up. You leave your life, you know. And go out for some promise of a better future, which is the American way. But that's what my family did, you know. And they came out here and... If a man and a wife's filed two different claims, homesteading claims, we could get 320 acres, like two people. And a lot of times there was brothers involved. That's what my family, like my dad's side of the family, the farm, they had like four brothers and they came out here and they all filed. And that's how we have a big farm. You know, like the part I farm, they have way more than that. Like other people in my family, which they don't use, they don't farm it now. They all live away and rent out the land and stuff, but the Homesteading Act is what started it. And so basically there was some families, like one family every square mile, you know? And as you saw when you drove out here, there's about one family every 20 square miles, you know? I mean, it's ridiculously empty and all the empty homesteads. But the bad thing about it is this country cannot support. It can't support, I mean, those poor people, and there's stories of my family telling me they had to eat rabbits. It was rough. Like, it was not pretty trying to live off, you know, I try to live off of 10,000 acres, and it's not very easy. And actually, if I had to do it the way they did, it would be pretty easy. You know, just kill deer, grow beef, grow a garden, right? Anyway, it's just hard to make it, so little by little, and that's how we got this ranch. My grandfather hauled water to this lady. She had 320 acres out here, half section. That's 1 mile long by a half mile wide. And her husband got killed in World War II. She's out here all alone, one kid. And no water, no well. A lot of these places, they couldn't afford to drill a well. I mean, drilling a well was a big deal. The water's, you know, 50 to 200 feet deep. And that it caused them lots of problems. Anyway, my grandfather hauled this lady water for like 5-8 years after her husband was killed in World War II. And, you know, she left as quick as she could afford to. And she left my grandfather this land. She deeded it. She handed him the deed the day she left, you know. And then other people, there's another 320 acres that he got out here that he traded a buggy for. You know, people wanted to leave and they needed a wagon to go there. And he had a wagon and he traded them their whole 320 acres, you know. So that's kind of how we pieced together this place. We did it the hard way for sure, you know. And when you see this country, you know why. It's hard to make a living. It's hard to make it pay. We do try to make it pay, you know. And having cows are a good deal, you know. If you have a cow calf, it's like once those cows are paid for, you keep those cows alive. The cow's like the goose that laid the golden egg. Every year you got a calf and that's money in the bank, you know. Cows are worth money and we got a real healthy herd. And so that's how we're making it. All these people that were out here and they just couldn't make it, but they had deeds to this land, you know. And they built houses and a lot of people lived in dugouts. It was like the only way you could make it out here, both sides of my family. I should take you there tomorrow. We have dugouts on our property. The original ones. They dug a hole in the ground and put a roof over it and lived there because the government wouldn't give you the deed to the land unless you were physically on the property for 3 years. And the wind and the lack of materials out here.
This was a subsistence community, subsistence economy, where they had to grow pretty much what they needed throughout the year. So they had some livestock. They had some pigs and some sheep, probably a few cattle, but not a lot because it takes a lot of a lot of feed to keep cattle alive. Probably the cattle and horses were more for transportation and pulling carretas and wagons and things like that.
Again, Dr. John Hunter.
They also grew some beans. They grew some vegetables like squash, melons. Probably grew some corn as well, but I'm not positive about that. And the Rio Grande would have water coming down from spring runoff, and then we also have a monsoon season down here, like the north. So periodically we'd get huge rainstorms that would refill the Rio Grande, but some summers might go dry. Probably one of the key events was the arrival of the railroad in 1881. Before that, it took months to get here from Mexico, months to get here from Kansas City. It took a long time. So once the railroad came and compressed that amount of time that people could come here and also that goods could go to market someplace else, that transformed the way that people lived around here, transformed the building materials that they used to build their houses, transformed what they grew, transformed where they could send their crops to. So instead of putting barrel of wheat on a wagon and having it arrive in Kansas City 90 days later, now they could put a barrel of wheat on a railroad and it would arrive in Kansas City 2 or 3 days later. So that transformed the way that farmers then started thinking of how to market their goods. And so it changed from a subsistence agricultural economy to a more market-driven economy of being able to send stuff away. I guess for agriculture here in southern New Mexico, before the World Wars, a key event happened, which was the creation of Elephant Butte Dam. And this is also a bit different than northern New Mexico. The Newlands Act of 1902 created a federal agency to create water management systems throughout the West. And the Newlands Act then put the muscle and the economic might of the federal government to start damming the rivers of the West. And so a lot of rivers were dammed. One of the early ones was the Rio Grande, just around Truth or Consequences, back then known as Hot Springs. So Elephant Butte Dam was built around 1915, 1916. And even before that, down here in the Mesilla Valley, irrigation systems were built in anticipation of the water that would be released from the Elephant Butte Dam through the growing season. Elephant Butte Dam started releasing water in the late 19-teens, and that transformed agriculture here because then farmers had a steady supply of water all summer long.
In a later show, we will hear how the institutionalized management of water, such as the Newlands Act of 1902, began to affect cultures that had used different rain catchment techniques for thousands of years. You're listening to The Shift of Land, where we focus on the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico.
Let me say one more consequence of what happened when EBID was created and allowed thirsty crops to be grown here. And that's that cotton was now a viable crop here. And so who came here to grow cotton were those people from the South who had grown cotton in the South. So there were immigrants who came to the Mesilla Valley from southern states, and they brought their own culture with them. So it wasn't until southern cotton farmers came to the Mesilla Valley in the 1920s that our schools were segregated. And when you're looking at land and culture and water, once water became plentiful for cotton farmers came here from the South and then started saying, we have to segregate our schools. And it wasn't segregated to white and Hispanic and black. It was the white and Hispanic children went together, but blacks had to go to a different school.
This is my ranch right here.
Slash Cross Ranch?
That's my
running
Slash
tea.
Cross Running Tea. That's my brand and everything.
Oh.
People out here know you by that more than they know you by anything else.
This is what they call high mesas. Elevation 4,900 feet. And it breaks away into rocky kind of grassland and arroyos. Basically, it's short grass country. It has to rain to get wheat or grass. And grass never grows too tall. If it'll hide a beer can, then you have a really good grass crop.
Is your farm
farm experience.
Can you kind of describe the process of dry land farming?
I have a farm that was my grandfather's. His name is Birchall Tillman, and he used to be a mail carrier to pay the bills, but he was a wheat farmer. And back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, you could actually make a living off of farming wheat, even if dry land, even if you only made a crop. Basically, they would say once every 5 to 7 years, if you made a crop, it would make you enough money. As long as you had a little part-time job or some food. You know, they grew gardens and had beef and stuff, but they would make enough money to buy a new truck, buy a new combine, and make it for 5 to 7 years. Once the world started growing wheat, basically, you know, we exported all of our technology, and so much wheat was grown in the world that the price went down. So actually the price that I get for wheat today is less than my grandfather got for wheat in 1951. Back then, a combine cost $5,000. Now it costs $250,000 to buy a combine. A new pickup back then, $3,500. Now, $35,000. So the economies of scale aren't working for the small wheat farmer as far as I only farm wheat to feed cattle. Like the great wheat's one of the only things that'll grow green in the winter. It can be totally freezing, a blizzard, and your cows can be out there. And as long as the wheat's sticking up out of the snow, they'll eat it. It's green. It's green all winter long. So that's a good thing about it. I grow it for that because it's the only thing green in the winter. And then it grows so fast. It's just so, you can't overgraze wheat. You know, the cows just eat it off, and then you can grow it again the next year, no problem. And we also grow our own seed wheat, so we don't have to buy it. So we cut some and put it in grain bins and store it until the next year where we plant it. And then if it's a good year, like this year, we've had a lot of moisture down here. We're about 6 inches so far for the year, and this is April 20th. And our normal total would be about 2.7 inches. So you can see we're very well over the mark of our normal moisture. So this year we're going to have a good wheat crop. So instead of making grain out of it, because I've already explained to you the way the grain prices are not favorable to the farmer, what I'll do is cut it, swath it down, and make it into hay bales. And then in the winter, those hay bales save my operation because I have to have fodder to feed cows when everything's covered. Because we get a lot of snow out here. You know, it's 4,900 feet. We're on this large mesa that faces north. And those storms slammed down on us. And, you know, the last two weekends before this weekend, April 20th, we've gotten 6 inches of snow both weekends. You know, so we're this far in the year. But it's really good for us. I would just as soon as snow all year round. Snow has nitrogen in it that helps wheat. And the more snow the wheat gets on it, the moisture kind of, you know, the snow melts into the wheat. It's better than rain because it all soaks in the ground. The only bad thing is the wind usually blows out here, and it can blow off.
The eastern, western, northern, and southern lands of New Mexico differ greatly. From dry plains to rock and sand mountains, dry and lush to hot and dry mountains and valleys, so do the cultures differ. In the east and southern parts, large spanses of dry and well-irrigated farmlands couldn't look more different to the long, thin varas of the northern farmlands. But like every part, people who live with the land are connected to it and all that it gives.
Right. Well, there have been big demographic changes. And again, I mean, this is happening in New Mexico, but it's not unique to New Mexico. Rural New Mexico has been exporting its youth and its labor for generations. This is since at least the late 19th century. And for a long time, up until, I think, well, certainly the 1930s, and then again during World War II and after World War II, the rural communities of New Mexico, people were leaving them in order to work first seasonally and then permanently.
The cultural landscape of New Mexico has been changing for hundreds of years now. University of New Mexico Professor of Anthropology, Dr. Sylvia Rodriguez, explains some of the changes that have come into what are today the more scenic and touristic areas in our more modern era.
And so there was, if you look at the census figures for those years, there was a population loss. I'm most familiar with the county of Taos, and it's interesting that during the 1930s, once people began to sort of make distinctions between ethnic groups in the census, it was clear that some people were migrating out and some people were moving in. The 20s, there was population loss. There was population loss in the 40s. There was population loss in the 50s. In the 30s, there was some regaining of population as some people came back during the Depression to get back on the land to farm. What began to happen in the 1960s was that even though there had been a steady trickle of Easterners, people from the Midwest who had moved into places like Taos and Santa Fe, where you had art colonies and which were becoming centers for tourism development, tourist attractions, people who would come as tourists and be enchanted by the place and decide that they wanted to move there, sometimes initially just for the summer. And this is how the art colonists got started in places like Taos and Santa Fe. They were trying to escape the anonymity, the disillusionment. In some cases, people thought that the loss of community, the loss of innocence, to get away from the polluted cities where there was crime and corruption and all of the evils of urban life. And they came to places like Taos and Santa Fe to escape that, and they saw this wonderful, rustic, primitive landscape that they and peoples, Native Americans and Mexican Americans, that they projected onto. And so there was this sense that they were coming here to recover something that they themselves had lost, or that their ancestors had lost by moving to the city. So there was this romantic notion of what New Mexico was. And so you had middle-class, urban, white people, what we call Anglos here in New Mexico, moving back, buying houses, and making a living here. And often their source of income was external to New Mexico. So that's been a trend here for a long time. But I don't think it was until around the 1960s, and then increasingly in the decades that came after, that more and more people began to move. Certainly the great hippie invasion of the 1960s would be one example, where you had these upheavals that were happening not only in this country, but also, for example, in France. And this was tied to, you know, these things that were happening that I don't know if we even fully understand what caused all of those upheavals of the 1960s, of which the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War and the protests against it and the psychedelic movement were all part of that, and the ethno-political mobilizations, not just the Black Power movement, but the Native American movement, the Chicano movement, then later the women's movement. All of these were part of what was going on. But the demographic change increasingly has been, I call them amenity migrants, not a term I invented, but that's used. These are people who come first as tourists and then decide to move here, not to get a job, because mostly people leave New Mexico to get a job, but to come back and to enjoy the amenities that brought them here first as tourists. And they generally have a higher level of education and income than the native people. They also often invested in the tourism industry and became developers of the tourism industry, also of real estate and of the construction industry. So they became sort of the new business owners of a lot of the services and the businesses that are connected to the tourism industry. So they could buy cheap and sell dear. And at the same time, you had people moving out for a living and selling their patrimony to get a foothold. So the whole process of gentrification, which is the replacement of a poorer population by a wealthier one, and a corresponding transformation of the architectural environment, people buying old broken down adobes and turning them into, you know, renovating them. Used to be, when I grew up, people would say that only the very rich or the very poor lived in adobe. Now the poor and even the lower middle class live in trailers, and only the rich live in adobes. unless you happen to have been able to hold on to your patrimony. That is, your family had adobe houses and had land, and people are holding on to that. But there are all these forces that sort of conspire against people holding on to their land, their adobe houses, and their water rights. Another really important demographic change that is taking place in New Mexico, and not just New Mexico, that doesn't get much recognition, and it hasn't been written about by scholars, is the movement of Mexican nationals. There's been this myth that somehow the Spanish Americans of New Mexico were pure Spanish, and almost as if, you know, they came here without having passed through Mexico, and that these villages were enclaves of Castilian culture. And that's a myth that was promoted largely by the tourism industry. And there are racial politics connected to that, because I think that also involves a certain claim to whiteness. But one thing that's been the case for generations is that, I mean, the border came in after the Mexican-American War. Before that, this was Mexico. And people were moving back and forth. And they continued to move back and forth after the Mexican-American War. And they continue to move back and forth today. I think if you talk to families who've been in New Mexico for generations, I'm talking about Nuevo Mexicanos, you will find if you talk to them about who's in their family, there will always be someone from Mexico. And there will usually be, you know, obviously Native Americans, whether they're Apaches or Navajo or Pueblo or Comanche peoples, who are part of their family tree that may or may not have been acknowledged, as well as what we call Anglos. But the movement of Mexican nationals into New Mexico is increasing. There's no question about it. Used to be, people would know in a small community who the Mexican nationals were, and there were certain kinds of, and there's always been a Chihuahua northern New Mexico axis, a pathway of migration. And I think it's moved both ways. But now there are people moving into the United States, every state in the Union. People are coming from Mexico and from other parts of Latin America, Central America. They are changing the demographics. They're changing the streetscapes. There are more and more businesses that cater to Mexicans, that are owned by Mexicans, not simply coming as itinerant workers, obviously as migrant workers and as farm workers and as construction workers, as service workers. But also, I think there are middle-class businesses developing, and I think they're largely uncounted. And when people talk about the mix in New Mexico, they sometimes leave that out. And it's a really interesting and important part of what's going on here. So that's also adds to the complexity of Latino populations or Mexican-American populations. They're not homogeneous. None of the populations under the big three, the big tri-ethnic myth of New Mexico, are monolithic. There are all kinds of complexity and mixes within them, and that's increasing, I think.
The cultural landscape of the state is constantly changing. Before it seemed that the land determined culture, but today the dominant culture of expansion and urbanism has affected the land and culture. This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rappet for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, Venado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder, associate producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.